It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next guest says it's time for non-Native people in Wisconsin to educate themselves about Native Americans and their role in the state and its history. That's coming up in just a bit.
First, Wisconsin's Democratic Convention is in Green Bay this weekend, and a group of Bernie Sanders supporters are planning to put forth proposals to abolish the superdelegate system and force the state's superdelegates to vote proportionally in the national convention this summer. Buzz Davis is a member of the Better with Bernie committee, and he joins us now. Buzz, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Buzz, tell us exactly what these proposals are and why you feel they're necessary.
Okay, Saturday is the day of resolutions for the Democratic Convention. And there is a resolution from Congressional District 1, which is in the southeast part of the state. And that resolution will be presented to the floor on the floor for discussion. And that calls for the Democratic National Committee to abolish the superdelegate concept in the election in 2020. And so what we're going to do is do an amendment to that resolution and add on that in 2016 that we strongly recommend that the Wisconsin delegation of superdelegates, 10 people, will split their votes proportionately in the same manner which we all voted on in April in the primary. So in the primary, 57% of the people voted for Sanders, 43% voted for Clinton. We think that 6 of the 10 superdelegates should be pledged to Sanders and 4 should be pledged to Clinton on each of the however many ballots they vote on for deciding the nominee and the convention in Philadelphia in July.
So clearly that would give more superdelegates to Sanders than to Clinton, but in broad strokes, what is your case for getting rid of the superdelegate system?
The superdelegate system is corrupt. We have primaries. We spend a lot of time working in primaries across the country. They cost a fortune. Public dollars are spent on the primaries. That's who pays for all the work that's done in the primaries. The politicians then spend their millions or hundreds of millions in ads and that sort of thing. But the primaries, the purpose of that is to find out which of the candidates who decide to run for a Republican or Democratic nominee the public is most interested in. And so the superdelegates are a concept which the Democratic National Committee dreamed up in the early 80s to be able to control the outcome of the selection of nominees.
Well, Bernie Sanders has spoken to this point. Let's hear what he has to say.
I don't know that you get rid of superdelegates in their entirety. I think there is a role for established people to play. But as I mentioned a moment ago, it is absurd that you have 400 establishment Democrats on board Hillary Clinton's campaign before anybody else was in the race. That stacks the deck in a very, very unfair way for any establishment candidate and against the wishes of the people.
So when it comes to superdelegates, Buzz, do you know how the people, how the electorate feels about superdelegates in Wisconsin? Do voters want them?
Well, we don't know how they feel in Wisconsin, but there is a recent poll which came out that shows that the vast majority, a significant majority of Americans think we should ditch the superdelegate concept. It is that 53% of the Americans poll, Americans as decided in this poll, think the superdelegate concept is a bad idea, and it says 17% of the Americans like it. So there's a little bitty error, you know, plus or minus 4% in that. But the superdelegate idea for Americans is one that should be ditched. And so there are five, maybe we'll be the sixth state Democratic Party that says ditch the superdelegate concept in 2020, DNC. So they don't like it. They don't like the primaries. They don't like what we call closed primaries, where only Democrats can vote or only Republicans can vote. They don't like the caucus system. They think the whole system is rigged. And then on top of that, when they get done and it's rigged with money, big money, buying people, buying candidates and running them like toys. Anyway, they don't like all of that stuff. And then we have them do all this work to think through who's the best candidate, go to the polls, all the rest of that stuff, which requires a lot of work on millions and billions of people in this country. And then the superdelegates come in and say, well, I thought it over, but you guys are all wrong. We really like Biden. Vice President Biden should be a good candidate, or somebody who else, whoever else they want to go for.
We're talking with Buzz Davis right now, member of the Better with Bernie committee, and he's looking for the Wisconsin Democratic Party to abolish superdelegates in the 2020 election and also force 2016 superdelegates to vote proportionally in this election. So, Buzz, let's say that happens. How does this affect Bernie Sanders in the race? And he's trailing Hillary Clinton right now when it comes to delegates, super and otherwise.
The first thing is state parties, Wisconsin included, cannot direct, require, force their superdelegates. We have 10 superdelegates. They cannot force those 10 superdelegates to do anything that they want to do. All we can do is ask them to do what we wish. And so that's what we will be doing on Saturday through the amendment through the resolution, which we hopefully will pass. And in other states, they'll be doing the same thing. And there will probably be resolutions on the floor of the National Convention doing the same stuff. But what was your question again?
What would change for Bernie Sanders? Well, here in Wisconsin, as you said, we have 10 superdelegates. So you ran down that he would get 6. But, I mean, do you think that if this were to happen, resolution-wise, nationwide, that that Bernie Sanders could have a shot at getting the nomination?
Oh, yes, he can. Everybody would like to, the media and Ms. Clinton and her campaign would like to have everyone believe the election is already over. Poor Bernie, why don't you just quit? The election is not over. We are in the fourth quarter, and between now and June 15th, 900 more delegates will be selected from on the basis of the primaries. 8 more primaries on the Democratic side will occur between now and June 15th. So basically, you look at the total number of delegates. We have about 4,000 delegates who will be going as representatives of their state to the National Convention. On top of that, you have 715 superdelegates who will be going to the convention as kings and queens. And so when you look at the pledged delegates, which means those coming from the states who are required to vote in the way that their state voted in the primaries, you have about 200 more people, delegates, are in favor of Clinton than Sanders. But when you add in the superdelegates, we have 500-plus superdelegates who have already decided, many have decided, way before Sanders or any of the other candidates were even in the race, that Hillary Clinton is the best person to be president. And so of the superdelegates, maybe 40 or 50, 60 are in favor of Sanders, 500 plus are in favor of Clinton, and then the others are undecided. So we're asking that all those superdelegates pledge to vote proportionally, which will neutralize their power at the convention.
So if this doesn't happen, now in your press release you ask why Democratic voters and independents should do their part to get out the vote, to contribute money, if the system isn't democratic and you're getting at the superdelegate issue there. Do you see any kind of retaliation happening or Sanders supporters staying home if this isn't passed and if Hillary Clinton gets the nomination?
If it happens that Representative Wasserman, who is from Florida, if she determines the whole convention will be tilted in favor of Clinton no matter what, in terms of the platform of the convention, the Democratic vice presidential nominee, all those sorts of things, if she tries to play that out like Mayor Daley did in the 1968 convention, there will be unknown consequences. So there will be thousands, possibly tens of thousands, of progressives outside the convention in Philadelphia pressuring for a progressive outcome in the convention. And so if Ms. Wasserman gives the state police and the Philadelphia police, who have a reputation of not being kind to citizens, if she gives them the go-ahead, as Mr. Daley gave the go-ahead to beat the hell out of the people in protesting the 1968 Democratic Convention, they were interested in peace, then we don't know what will happen. I hope that doesn't happen, but these people have to be smart enough to see the handwriting on the wall. And it's for the Democratic leaders, they have to realize the public is fed up with this system. They have to realize that they do not like the superdelegate concept. And if she lets the superdelegate concept determine who will be the president, Hillary or presidential nominee, Hillary or Sanders, she's falling into the hands of those of the many, many of us who say, I am pretty fed up with the Democratic Party.
And we leave it there. Buzz, thank you so much for joining us.
Bye-bye.
That was Buzz Davis, a member of the Better with Bernie Committee, who intends to introduce resolutions at this weekend's Wisconsin Democratic Party Convention to abolish superdelegates in the 2020 election and ask 2016 superdelegates to vote proportionally this election.
Wisconsin is a place with a deep Native American heritage. You can see it in the names of lakes and towns up and down the state. But our next guest says in many ways Wisconsin's Native American population has been left out of key conversations today about policy, community, and the making of laws.
Winona Wolf is with us now. She grew up on the St. Croix Chippewa Reservation in northwest Wisconsin and is an enrolled member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. She's the Communication and Development Manager for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families and its Race to Equity Project. And she recently wrote a piece about what it's like to be Native in Madison for Madison Magazine. Winona, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you write in your piece that you've become a huge Badger basketball super fan. This is largely in part, largely thanks to Bronson Koenig, who's up front and very vocal about being Ho-Chunk. I wonder what it was like for you seeing Koenig out front in the national spotlight talking about being Ho-Chunk and also his take on Native mascots.
It's pretty amazing. What I'm most amazed at is that at such a young age, he's really embracing being a strong role model for Native Americans. You know, unfortunately, more often than not, we don't have a lot of role models that are kind of out in the spotlight. So I think he's done a really good job of embracing it and speaking to those issues. And it was actually something that I couldn't do at that age. So I really appreciate and I'm proud of what he's doing.
So you have this pride and you love seeing him play, but on the other hand, you tell a story about people who don't get it, even though there's Koenig talking about the harm he feels is being done with Native mascot imagery, and you ran into people who still didn't get it. What happened?
Yeah, I was, it was actually the championship game 2 years ago, and I was sitting in a local hangout, a bar with some friends, and as Bronson's name was called during the starting lineup, the guy next to me kind of started doing these war chants and, you know, these kind of infamous cheers that we hear coming from some professional sports teams. And it just, it ruined my night. It put me in such an uncomfortable and awkward situation, you know, and especially having someone who has been speaking about that issue. And I confronted. I'm always, you know, wondering, do I confront people in these situations? Is it better to walk away? And I actually confronted the person, and he insisted that he was honoring Koenig, but had obviously not heard what Bronson had been speaking to. So
Now, I get the sense that that story isn't necessarily a one-off for you, where someone doesn't understand or honor or understand the history and tradition of Native Americans in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. but that there are other things that happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a little unfortunate, you know, living here in Madison, where we really pride ourselves on being very well-educated and being a very liberal and progressive city, I encounter people at, you know, whether it's meetings or, you know, kind of events that... It's clear to me that they haven't had the education that I think people in Wisconsin and people in our country should really be getting about Native Americans and who we are and, you know, our beliefs and just kind of all of the issues that are affecting our culture.
And here Wisconsin has a very deep influence from Native Americans. Why do you think the education component hasn't been there?
You know, I'm not really sure. Wisconsin actually does have an act that mandates that public schools are to be, you know, are supposed to be teaching this. I don't know if it's lack of resources for some of our teachers and they aren't able to, and whether it's really, it's not made a priority, unfortunately, in our city, in our state, and in our country. And I think a lot of it is reflective of how our country in general has treated the Native populations and the policies that have been created that kind of put us out of sight. I mean, we aren't all walking around here in Madison or here in Wisconsin. A lot of us are on reservations in very rural areas, or we're kind of mixed in with our urban populations and other communities of color.
So do you think it's a matter of being more vocal, or is it a matter of making sure for the policymakers, the dominant voices there, that there is a place at mm-hmm. the table for Native Americans and being sure to include that population? Mm-hmm. Even if it's 1%, it's an important 1%.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things that I'm hoping we can all kind of play our part. And, you know, for me, it's being more vocal about the issues and working on these issues and raising my voice. But, you know, I also ask a lot of my colleagues that work in kind of the nonprofit or the political arenas to think about us when they are working on their issues, because more likely than not, when, you know, we're talking about health or we're talking about the justice system, the Native American population is being affected, and they're being affected in big ways.
And tell us about some of those ways. You run through some of the issues that you see mm-hmm. facing Native communities. You want attention paid. What do we need to know?
Yeah, I mean, there's some alarming statistics that you come across when you start looking at the Native population here in Wisconsin. Native American men are locked up at higher rates here in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the country. The health disparities are relatively alarming. Right now, Native American people are dying, I believe it's 6 or 7 years sooner than the white population. Native Americans are 4 times more likely to die of diabetes than the white population. We see low graduation rates. We see very high unemployment rates. And, you know, unfortunately, it's one of the things where, like, the list can go on and on. And what's particularly startling for me is that it's really affecting our youth. We see teenage youth suicide rates among Native Americans 2.5 times higher than the national average.
We're talking with Winona Wolf right now. She grew up on the St. Croix Chippewa Reservation, and she's the Communication and Development Manager for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. And Winona, you say that one thing you hear when you're making this point is that it's too hard to work with the tribes. Mm-hmm. It's hard to bring these voices in. Why do people say that, and what do you say in return to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things at play when you start working with tribes. First, you know, I think tribes are very overwhelmed because they're dealing with these issues, you know, right in the forefront and providing the services for their tribal members and helping those that are struggling, you know. And I also think that the relationship between tribes and the state and tribes and the federal government is rather complex. You know, it's something that not a lot of people are versed on, so it's hard to understand. And again, going back to these policies that were kind of created that pushed us out of the conversation and kind of out of mainstream society. But I think we need to start doing a better job.
So what could the tribes themselves do to do that better job? I mean, you're doing it. You're mm-hmm. publishing in Madison Magazine. You're on the radio. Mm-hmm. But what would you like to see other Native Americans do in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, I think for one thing that tribes can do is just continue to be vocal about these issues and raising awareness. I know in the past couple of years there's been some issues, you know, at the state capitol, some laws that were about to be enacted, and the tribes did rally together and say, you know, we're here and these are really going to affect us. And I hope to continue to see that from the tribes. I hope to see our younger generations become vocal and really advance themselves in social justice and advance themselves in education so they can also tackle these issues.
Now, one thing you say in your piece is that people need to take it upon themselves if they're not Native American and they're not educated about this history and this culture and the issues involved with Native people in Wisconsin. They need to get educated. Mm-hmm. They need to do it themselves. Where do they start?
I think there's a lot of simple things that they can start doing. There's plenty of Native American authors out there. There's Native American.
Can you name some for us?
Yeah. Patty Lowell here at UW-Madison has put out a great book on tribes in Wisconsin. Sherman Alexie is a very famous author. Antoine Truer is also wrote some really great books on just kind of what it's like to be Native American, and he explains it, you know, basically to the white population. I think there are some amazing Native media sites online that people can jump on and start reading what current issues are really affecting tribes throughout the country and tribes here in Wisconsin.
And in that same vein, if you were designing the curriculum in schools in Wisconsin, what would you be assigning as coursework? Who would you want to come in as speakers? Mm-hmm. And what do you want people talking about?
Well, I think the main thing that needs to happen is that we start, you know, teaching appropriate studies on Native Americans. You know, we need to get over this very stereotypical image that we have of Natives and living in teepees and war paint. And I think what schools can start doing is reaching out to the tribes and reaching out to Native Americans and asking them to play a role in creating this curriculum and playing a role in teaching the students.
In northern Wisconsin, where there is a higher concentration of reservations and maybe Native people, do you think that that equation is any better in northern Wisconsin?
Maybe in some parts, I mean, but unfortunately, I grew up just outside of a reservation, and I don't know how much education I got about my own people. Hopefully, it's improved over the years, and I hope that they are taking advantages of having those populations near them that could really serve as some great teaching tools.
Oh, Winona, thank you so much for joining us and sharing today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It was Winona Wolf. She grew up on the St. Croix Chippewa Reservation in northwest Wisconsin, and she's an enrolled member of the Mililac's Band of Ojibwe. She's a communication and development manager for the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families and its Race to Equity Project.
A lot of comedic writers and comedians have drawn on their own families and their personal experiences for inspiration, and our next guest is following that tradition, but drawing from a very different background than the average English language sitcom.
Zarqa Nawaz has built her career on the characters in her Pakistani-Canadian family and the humor and common experiences like navigating parent-child relationships, going to summer camp, getting married, and having children.
She created the world's first sitcom about a Muslim community living in the West. Little Mosque on the Prairie ran for 6 successful seasons on the CBC in Canada and is now being broadcast to over 60 countries. Her memoir is titled Laughing All the Way to the Mosque, The Misadventures of a Muslim Woman. Zarqa, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us the story of how you ended up, your family in Pakistan, finding yourself in Regina, Saskatchewan, the capital there.
Well, you'd have to go all the way back to 1947 when the British sort of separated Pakistan from India. So that was when my father's side was on the wrong part, I guess, of India and had to be moved to the right side, I guess, because they were Muslim. And so it was a very traumatic experience, you know, living in refugee camps and then moving by train. And I think it was the biggest mass migration of humans at that time. And so when he moved to Pakistan, and, you know, they lost everything, their home, the land that they had, their jobs, he became obsessed with education because he felt that that was the only thing you could really take with you. And so he became an engineer, a structural engineer. And at that time, England was looking for a lot of educated immigrants, particularly engineers, because they were, you know, rebuilding after World War II. And they were built in Liverpool. They were building something called the Mersey Tunnels, for people who are familiar. So he went to England, and then shortly later he got married. And then Canada was looking for educated immigrants for, you know, for building purposes. So that was the routing, you know, from Pakistan to England to Canada. And so he moved there with his wife and kids. And then gradually over time, I grew up, I came into existence and I grew up, and I met this guy from Saskatchewan, and I was like, oh my God, you know, I don't know if I can marry you if it means living out in the prairies. Because, you know, people who live in the urban centers of the world think, you know, we are the center of the universe and can't go anywhere else. However, love takes us to many places, and now I am here in Saskatchewan, which is a wonderful province. I want everyone who's listening to me to know. Wouldn't change anything. So there you go. It's a very long, convoluted tale, which is why I had to write the book. And for those really confused Americans who are listening, you can actually see Little Mosque on the Prairie on Hulu, which I believe is a streaming service in the U.S.
Well, Zarko, take us back to your childhood, because I know at that time you were very aware of differences between yourself and some of your schoolmates. You didn't have the neat little sandwiches. You had chicken legs wrapped in tinfoil. You didn't have those light summer dresses. What did you notice about how you felt different?
It's so interesting, right? Like I tell a lot of people, like when you're a kid with parents who are immigrants, or even, you know, I've even had children tell me, you know, they had hippies for parents, and it wasn't until they got to school with their recess and they had, you know, their carob cupcakes or their, you know, you know, really healthy snack food, you know, and other kids are like, we don't eat those things. Where did you get that? Like, and you know, so my sandwiches were like these curry drumsticks wrapped in tinfoil, dripping, you know, in oil, and everyone else had these beautiful sandwiches that smelled like perfume and vanilla. I was like, why can't I be like those children? And that's when you start to realize that there's these differences, and there's not much, you know, some differences you can change, like talking to your mom and getting different, you know, food packed, but other things like your skin color, you know, or the way you speak, I mean, those things were harder. And so you start to navigate those differences, like what is my identity, how do I fit in, what can I change, what can't I change, what do I want to change, what do I want to keep. And those are things that are, you know, going through your mind as like a little kid subconsciously, and they start to change who you are as a person as you grow up.
A lot of your book talks about navigating that identity, not just with the non-Muslim community in the area, but with the Muslim community and your own family. And you were a teenage rebel in some ways by becoming more religious than your parents, at least for a little while. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, so for a lot of teenagers, you know, the coming of age story is the rebellion and doing all the things that your parents don't want you to do. But you can also have those rebellions by identifying with aspects of your faith that your parents didn't necessarily identify with. Because when you grow up Muslim in a Muslim country, you know, it's just in the zeitgeist, it's just in the air. I mean, people just do what they do because they're Muslim, and they just assume that's what all Muslims do, and it's just a Muslimy thing to do. But then when you come here to North America and your parents start to, you know, send you to like summer Islamic camp or Muslim camp or, you know, the mosque, and then you start learning the religion in a different way than your parents learned it. And so for me, you know, a big difference was how women are treated in mosques. Like my mom said growing up, she never went to a mosque, which is, you know, a house of worship. It just wasn't the thing to do. And that was because, you know, years and years of sort of patriarchy, you know, through the centuries had sort of eliminated women from that prayer space. But in North America, you know, we would sort of read about Islam, and there would be like these stories of these really powerful women who would not only go to the mosque, but actually stand up and speak when they would hear, you know, things being said in the mosque that they didn't feel were correct, or they felt that their rights were being violated, and they would stand up and they would say things. And so I'd be like, okay, so my parents come from this world where they didn't go to the mosque, yet I'm reading in the 7th century that women yelled at men and took them to task for, you know, being misogynist, what's going on here? And so there was this sort of disconnect with my parents and myself, because I was learning about it in a very different way from a non-cultural perspective, so more from a human rights and gender equality perspective. And so that was confusing, you know, to my parents. And then, you know, this whole aspect of covering the hair, and, you know, like it really appealed to sort of my feminist sensibilities, because I felt like, well, you know, if women are so highly sexualized in society, what's a way of sort of saying, okay, I'm going to decide what I expose on my own terms. I'm going to take agency of my body and decide for myself what I want. And, you know, my mom didn't wear a headscarf. She wore like shalwar kameez. And that was like a really radical statement, you know, to my mom. It was probably like what it was like burning bras back when daughters did that, you know. So it was like, what is happening? Like, their kids are growing up Muslim, the same religion, but very different, you know, expressions of faith. And that was really hard, you know, for parents who hadn't seen faith in quite the same way we had. But we were growing up in a different culture and a different, you know, country. And you know, we needed to form a sense of identity and belonging that we could relate to.
We're talking right now to Zarko Nawaz. She created the world's first sitcom about a Muslim community living in the West, Little Mosque on the Prairie, and it premiered to record ratings on the CBC in 2007. And her new book is called Laughing All the Way to the Mosque. And Zarko, a big chunk of your book or at least a thread running through it, is food. There are some different stories there that center around cooking and food. And I wonder if you'll tell us a story about the time that you invited the entire community, Muslim or not, to your home to the celebration of Eid. It didn't quite go the way you'd planned.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was shortly after 9/11 when I was sort of looking around, you know, when I went to pick up my kids from daycare, and I realized, you know, that I didn't really know a lot of my neighbors. Like, you know, we had recently moved, and I felt like, well, how can I blame people for misunderstanding Muslims if I myself haven't really reached out and done more sort of, you know, neighborly events and gotten to know people? And so I told my kids that they could invite everyone that they wanted to our home for Eid. And, you know, in Eid, this is a celebration after Ramadan. Ramadan is about to begin, you guys, on Monday, where Muslims abstain from drinking and eating from dawn to sunset. And so I did that, and they invited, like, everyone. And I realized really quickly that I would have to learn to cook those curry drumsticks that my mom, you know, had made so diligently for me when I was a little kid, because people wanted to eat something that was more sort of different, ethnic-y, you know. My kids love that food because it's not as common for them as it was for me growing up. And so, you know, through a lot of trial and error, I cooked this huge meal. And all these people started coming. And what happened over the years was my kids started inviting more and more of their teachers and, you know, football coaches and basketball playmates and the neighbors, that it got so big that we could no longer fit the people in our house. We ended up having to rent a tent and put it in the backyard. And we would get sort of, now we get, you know, hundreds of people coming every year. And in fact, it's become less of a Muslim holiday and more of a community holiday, because the kids know this is the time of year where they can reach out and invite everyone that, you know, means something to them. And that's in the end what I think, you know, celebrating our holidays is really about in North America, is it's an opportunity to invite people who don't necessarily belong to our communities or our faith groups to meet one another and get to know one another and share food and break bread, because there's no better way to instill a sense of, you know, companionship than eating with one another and sharing.
Another theme in your book and your show is, I think, the common misconceptions non-Muslims have about Muslims, or just those misunderstandings, often even well-meaning. What's one of the most common things you encounter?
Oh, my God, there's, like, so many. Like, you know, Muslim women who wear the headscarf, like, why are you doing that? Is some man oppressing you? Are you forced to do that against your will? You know, that's a really common one about the way Muslim women choose to dress. And not all of us choose to wear the headscarf. You know, I have two girls, two daughters. One wears it, one doesn't. You know, and it doesn't make any difference to me in terms of, you know, their adherence to their faith. Some women are just more comfortable, and some women are not, and I think that's fine. I mean, you know, there's also misunderstandings about violence and, you know, are Muslims more prone to violence or anger, or that, you know, in the Quran. I was actually at the bank teller the other day, and one of the bank tellers kind of, she looked at me, she goes, I just have, you know, I hope you don't get offended, but I have this question I want to ask. And I said, sure. And she's like, is it true in your religion you have to kill everyone that doesn't convert? And I was like, no, that is not true. And in fact, I'm not going to kill you if you choose not to, you know, deposit my money. Maybe for that. No, I'm just kidding. So anyway, so, you know, I mean, it was so interesting when she said that to me. And she goes, because, you know, I've read this thing. And I was like, no, you know, there are a lot of, you know, very complicated political, geopolitical reasons for why things happen. But in general, no. I mean, what Muslim parents want for their kids is what any parent wants for their kids. You know, a good education, you know, move out, preferably to your own house. Don't, you know, come and visit with your grandkids, but don't live in my basement. You know, the regular stuff that everyone wants, right? And you know, we do believe, you know, one God, the same God as everyone else, and we do believe in, like, you know, being an upstanding citizen, recycling. Recycling is a big one, you know. Animal rights is huge. Pretty much the same things everyone else believes. And that's hard sometimes because, you know, when you see relentless television shows like Homeland or the news constantly about strife in the Middle East, it tends to color people's perception of this really normal, boring, banal community that's just trying to pay their bills and get through life.
Zarqa Nawaz is with us right now. She's talking about her new memoir, Laughing All the Way to the Mosque, The Misadventures of a Muslim Woman. And she's also the creator of the Canadian series Little Mosque on the Prairie, which ran for 6 seasons.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're not Muslim, do Zarqa's stories and characters remind you of your own family, your own experiences, maybe especially if you're from an immigrant family? If you're a Muslim in Wisconsin or our neighborhood, what are some of the misunderstandings and miscommunications you've run into with non-Muslim friends and neighbors? Or if you just have a question about living as a part of a Muslim community in the West, call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. We're continuing our conversation with Zarqa Nawaz. Her recently released memoir is Laughing All the Way to the Mosque, The Misadventures of a Muslim Woman, which relates her experiences growing up as a Canadian of Muslim faith.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're Muslim and living in Wisconsin, what kind of differences do you see with non-Muslims and what do you have in common? If you've seen Zarqa's TV series, Little Mosque on the Prairie, what do you think? What did it bring up for you? Do the stories that you're hearing bring to mind your own experiences? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org.
Zarqa, one theme again through your book and your career is looking at these issues or relations between Muslims and non-Muslims in the West with a humorous lens. Why is that important?
I don't know. I mean, people always ask me that. Why do you do it on purpose? And I would have to say no. It's just that whenever something is really serious, my brain has this way of twisting it into its more kookier element and then processing the world in that way. It's sort of the way I've always been able to handle situations. And so it's worked out well because I've been able to communicate, you know, really interesting, concepts about community and faith and religion and mosque to both Muslims and non-Muslims. And it makes people more comfortable talking about things they wouldn't necessarily feel they could normally talk about. But when you make them laugh, then they're like, oh my God, you know, that I have someone just like that in my church or my synagogue, you know, that says or does the same thing, or even a secular environment like the bank or my soccer association that's just as cranky and does similar things. And then people are able to sort of lower their guard and to sort of talk to each other as regular people.
Let's talk a little bit about your TV show, Little Mosque on the Prairie. Now, you had that lens of humor taken to religion, which can be a touchy thing. How did it go over in your own religious community there?
Well, at first, you know, sort of the more conservative, older generation was a little bit worried because, you know, in that community, they feel that when you make fun of people or you make fun of religious people, you're actually making fun of religion itself. And so it took them a while to sort of watch the show and realize that, you know, it was sort of a good-natured comedy about situations and that I wasn't actually, you know, making fun of the sacred or something. And then gradually over time, as they realized that they were bonding, you know, with their non-Muslim colleagues at work over the show, then nothing nefarious was happening because they were worried that the show would give even a worse impression of Islam and Muslims than we already had. And why was I just adding fuel to the fire by washing our dirty laundry? But in fact, the opposite was happening. So they got over it very quickly.
We heard from Malik who called in. Malik says he's a Muslim living in Superior, Wisconsin. That's in the northern part of our state. Doesn't have many Muslim friends. Malik says lives alongside other non-Muslims and says he lives a normal life. So that I imagine it really depends on where you are, Zarqa, if you have that local community of fellow Muslims or not. Do you think, harder or easier to fit in with non-Muslims if you do or don't have that community to rely on?
I think it depends on you as a person. Like, if you're a friendly, outgoing person, then it doesn't matter where you live, right? I mean, you could live within a Muslim community and still have a hard time getting along if you're the type of person who's very judgmental and rigid and wants things done their way. So I think it depends on you as a person. I mean, as humans, we tend to like to live with people who are similar to ourselves in terms of worldview and outlook. But I mean, you can find that, you know, even outside of your religious communities with, you know, other people who belong to different faith communities or non-faith communities. And I think it's just a matter of reaching out and making those contacts and, you know, cooperating with people and being part of the, you know, wider society that you live in.
Zarqa, I want to take you back to something you began talking about a little earlier of feminism in Islam. And I know there's a part in your book where you talk about confronting some of these issues. And you write about a particular moment when you say your mosque, you call it a shower curtain, put a shower curtain between the men and the women, and you had questions about that. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of, you know, the whole patriarchal notion of women are temptations to men, you know, comes up, and then some men feel like, oh, well, women should be behind curtains. And I remember watching a documentary called Half My Kingdom by a Jewish feminist who also had the same issue in synagogues. And that was when I realized, oh my God, this is like a universal issue across all faiths, across all communities, where men have this thing where they have to sort of control spaces and control women through dress or behavior, you know, or through language. And that, you know, all of us, regardless of where we come from or where, you know, where we're going, have this issue with having to, you know, assert our rights as women and say we, you know, we want our spaces to be safe. We need our spaces so that women can speak up. We don't need to be hidden or protected. You know, men are strong enough to, with, you know, deal with temptation, and we shouldn't, you know, insult men by thinking that's the only, you know, sphere that they have, that they're always tempted and needed to be protected, and that we need to be more mature as adults. So that was, you know, the idea, you know, of making the documentary Me in the Mosque. That's where it came from. And a lot of Muslims felt that it was time to talk about, you know, airing our dirty laundry and talking about these issues. And we shouldn't keep hiding them because we're worried it'll make us look worse. Because, in fact, what happened was people would come out and say, oh, my God, this also happens in my space of worship. And I'm glad you guys brought it up because it means that, you know, we have similar struggles when it comes to women's rights.
Talking to Zarqa Nawaz, her memoir is Laughing All the Way to the Mosque, The Misadventures of a Muslim Woman. And talking about the differences within the community points out, I think maybe a lot of people in the West think Muslim, and that's one category, and all these things get attached to that. Is it important for the rest of us to know there are a lot of differences of opinion and of culture and food and you name it within the Muslim world?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a billion of us. I hope that doesn't scare you. And that, you know, we speak different languages. You know, we have different outlooks. We, you know, a lot of us, there's different ways of looking at Islam and the way we practice Islam. I mean, I, as a Muslim, practice Islam very differently than even my parents do. And I'm their daughter, right? And my children will go on to practice Islam differently from the way I do. And they're my children because we each grow up in a different time and a different culture. And we look at things, you know, through our lens and our experience. And so, you know, I mean, my daughter's a football player. She plays rugby. She's a lifeguard. You know, she's much more sport-oriented than I ever was. And she incorporates her faith into her sports. You know, we pray five times a day, and her teammates know that she prays, and they encourage her to pray, and they're always, like, watching her going, isn't it time? Shouldn't she be off the field? You know, they know that she fasts. So it's so interesting to me that her life, you know, revolves very much around sport and faith, and she's integrated those two elements in a way that I wouldn't have thought possible because I wasn't, you know, a really sport-oriented person. So I think that's so interesting to see how the next generation, you know, takes faith and kind of converts it into a reality that works for them.
You got into television and entertainment, and it's been really well received, but we hear all the time about how women face a barrier when they enter sort of the film and TV entertainment industries, and you are also, you know, a Muslim woman. So what was that experience like for you? Was it difficult to break into that industry?
It's so interesting. People ask me this all the time, right? Because in 2007, I don't think I was even aware that it was a thing for women to be creating sitcoms and writing comedy. And I mean, I didn't think there was any reason a woman shouldn't be allowed to do it, so we just did it. And then, you know, gradually you would start to realize that, you know, sometimes there were men in the room that weren't as comfortable knowing that a woman was as funny as them or could pitch a smarter or more sharper joke. And then you realize that, you know, the sexism that sort of, say, I was so obsessed with, so in the mosque community, also existed in a comedy room, right? That there were actually men there that would take that seriously and feel a little bit like you've sort of overstepped the bounds as a woman by pitching like a smarter, funnier joke. And then you would watch, sometimes strange things would happen where a joke would be disappeared and you'd be like, whoa, what just happened? And so it was a fascinating learning curve for me that no matter what area you enter as a woman, if you're the first one or you're breaking new ground, that you're going to experience sort of the sexism or this misogyny that exists, even from men who may not necessarily think that they are, you know, misogynists. But there's a subconscious, you know, behavior that they may not be aware of that exists. And so I became really conscious of that. And, you know, this was before all the, you know, diversity and women consciousness that we see now in media and television. And even, you know, like back then there were no television shows that had a diverse cast that had crossed over to the mainstream. So we were very much the pioneers in North America. Other than The Cosby Show, I don't think we had seen a show like this before that had gone over to the mainstream. And you know, when I went to Los Angeles and they talked about this show, they told me it gave them so much confidence that a show like this could cross over. And then years later, now we see Black-ish and Dr. Ken and Fresh Off the Boat. And I feel like this show gave a lot of executives sort of the strength and the confidence that it was possible to do.
Thanks to Zarqa Nawaz. Her memoir is Laughing All the Way to the Mosque, The Misadventures of a Muslim Woman. And her show Little Mosque on the Prairie ran for 6 years on the CBC. If you've ever wanted to escape to a magical world of TV imagination, now you can thanks to a new auction. It's your chance to own one of over 1,500 props from the TV show Mad Men.
That's right. Online bidding started yesterday afternoon, the one-year anniversary of the show's final episode.
Now, I only watched for about a season of Mad Men. It didn't grab me. I don't know why. So I don't recognize all these items. Some of them I do. So you can see the list online. Jones' office ice bucket and tumbler set. Don Draper's ice bucket and scotch glass set. There's a lot of alcohol related paraphernalia for some reason. That I did pick up from the show.
Also, sunglasses and maybe more curiously, a set of yellow and green floral sheets apparently used during a sex scene.
Yeah, they have a picture of the scene these sheets are in. I'll just say the number of people in this bed is greater than two. Whoa. So I don't know if you want these yellow and green floral sheets.
Also
wash them first.
A gold coffee table, cards, wood panel station wagon.
Right, and Don Draper's convertible. I think I watch TV all wrong, though, because when I'm watching, I'm never thinking, ooh, I wish I owned that set of sheets or scotch glass set. Or I just watch.
But we have colleagues
I'm
here at WPR who have recreated, without the alcohol, I think, the
ambience.
The Don Draper office
Mystique,
vibe. They've got it going on. So some people are really into this.
Well, I'll watch to see if they make a bid. This is Central Time.